Welcome back, so it is you again. We have Till, Ava and Aksana discussing books by Julie. Mm-hmm. And there's a David Montgomery. This is really, really, and really confusing. But happy that it's you did say. But you've got 2 hours scheduled for this.
I will start from Magnus' book. I prepared my presentation referring to him as you discussed, so I have to change my presentation, make it as in a third person. So, book of.
Yeah, he's sitting there.
Good to be Magnus.
So this was a book like a favorite for me while I was reading this book. This gave impression as the favorite movie because I really wanted to reread it again and again. It has a really easy language and also engaging and beautiful ethnography and a really great contribution to theory. So I was very impressed, even though it was really long, but still, you wouldn't feel this. So the book of Magnus is about Afghan traders, mainly about their professional activism, trading routes, roads, strategies, techniques to cross national borders. So in other words, Afghans trading in a globalized world that go beyond cultural, religious, and ethnic lines due to their mobilities and their trading skills across multiple borders. So he challenges several theoretical perspectives by giving convincing ethnographic vignettes. So Marsden has done extensive research for decades in Central Asia, mostly in Afghanistan and also in Tajikistan, from diverse perspectives and different angles. So many of his informants were his close friends and acquaintances that have been established for a long period of time. And his method of investigation was based on in-depth interviews, participant observation, but due to ethical problems, he intentionally didn't look at the drug and opium traders. And also he also didn't cross the border together with his informants. Instead of calling, he says, Afghan traders as diaspora traders, Marsden claims that it would be better to conceptualize their affiliation as Afghan traders network because of their heterogeneity and diversity in different contexts. Moreover, Marsden argues that Afghan traders' worlds shed lights on aspects of people's lives in a manner that transcends a simplistic dichotomy between peripheries and centers, mm-hmm. and formal and informal economies. Page 4. This book doesn't only look at the survival strategies of traders, but also he says that this is a meaningful work and action ties to changing forms of commitment, sentiments, and desires. So he, in other words, engaged in a local and dynamic global context in an increasingly interdependent world by taking into account key dynamics like constant mobility of traders, goods, ideas that cross across borders. So in Afghanistan and in Tajikistan, as we all know, in general and also particular, it's common for men to seek work abroad, engage in trade by leaving their families behind or getting another family in the host countries. However, from my own experience, my own fieldwork experience in Kyrgyzstan, for example, Kyrgyz women were the ones who were engaged in trade right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were called as Chelnakim. And some of the women couldn't stay longer, unlike Afghan traders, find new dimension of lives. So women have controversial wishes and needs for, and different strategies of engaging into the worlds of traders. And emotionally, they were also bound to their families of origin as well as to their children. And they would, while being abroad, trader women, they would also contribute to the maintaining of patriarchy back in their own communities. So emotionally, and this was, of course, this was not his intention to focus on women, but gendered aspect also that I thought was missing in his work. Mm-hmm. And then this idea came to, I just wanted to speculate what would have been trajectories of women if this were Afghan woman. So, and how about Afghan woman? So once I finished reading the book about the Afghan men and their trading activities, I started to be interested more about Afghan women. And then second book is about Afghan women. So here. And this book of Julie gives us an opportunity to enter the world of Afghan women. The book opens us with the socio-economic, socio-political context of Afghanistan by specifically focusing on Afghan women. Against this background, the reader is introduced to the rich description of everyday life of women. One of the aims of her book is to capture nature of the reconstruction project in Afghanistan using the category woman as entry point into the broader question about sovereignty, state building, and democratization. So the focus of this book is on how two regimes that have been shaping the practices of local women throughout the history. So Soviet invaders in 1979 on the one hand, on the other hand, the impact of the US, Western international organizations, NGO, military in the post-Taliban era in Afghanistan. So the woman's body as oppressed was always at the center of attention and legitimizing factors of violence by both the US as well as Soviet invaders. So they claimed the importance of liberalizing and modernizing this so-called oppressed women, restoring their rights in their own countries. So description around the coping strategies of local women to the unprecedented socio-political changes occurring throughout different regimes. Julie provided us with a detailed description of the lives of women, their negotiation with their symbols, whether modern or traditional. And she also shows how women find their own ways between of different power battles, such as being active, invisible in public by using their own gendered performance and clothing. At the same time, they don't violate the rules of the existing social norms and structures of the society. So here she refers to the cultural intimacy of Michael Hertzfeld, which was quite convincing and compelling, and her ethnographic data really could show this. And ethnographic material presented includes ethnographic data through in-depth interviews, participant observation, which shows Julie actively participated in the everyday life of women and gained their trust. She also lived with the female students at the Kabul University's dormitory and worked in the social communication agency for the social communication agency. This access allowed her insight into the gendered aspect of society. But at the same time, Julie admits that some women were not open to her and suspicious. She had access to women who were actively, publicly active, spoke foreign languages, worked for the government or international organizations. So this implies that they were active segments of society. While reading your book, several questions came to my mind. What about other women who were not active, didn't speak foreign languages, and didn't have any state or international organization positions? To what extent these responses and your argument can be applicable to other segments of women in Afghanistan? Last year, I did research in Osh on Osh women in Kyrgyzstan, specifically focusing on leader women and their contribution to peace building during and in the aftermath of Osh conflict in 2010. And of course, their roles were not visible. But I looked at how complex social skills and attentiveness involved in the women's efforts at building peace and navigating ethical commitments and concerns, the commitments to preserving the image of a male authority, care of the other, which at the same time care for the family and community, and their views on communal coexistence, or I would call here as peace building, and it takes to create it differ from the views of men and many other international organizations. So I see here a lot of parallels between women in Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan, especially when we are focusing on leader women who can speak several languages and very active in public lives. But I also didn't look at the other segments of women who were not that active. And I wanted to know your opinion on this issue. And final book is about practicing Islam. So this book brings to light the everyday practice of Islam in Kyrgyzstan through the prism of anthropology of knowledge, and based on extensive field ethnographic fieldwork between 2005 to 2013 in northern and southern Kyrgyzstan, as well as in Uzbekistan, David gives us a detailed account of the learning of Islam as individuals and attain religious knowledge by arguing that people that practice is not only what people do, but they learn what to do. So in his scientific investigation, David follows the theoretical framework of Barthes' conception of knowledge, which is mainly consists of three interrelated parts, such as social organizations, corpus, and medium. And he specifically addressed the question of how knowledge concept is capable of capturing the complexities of practicing Islam in everyday lives of individuals better than culture and or religion. According to David, where people's lives are constricted by seen and unseen realities, relationship of varying closeness, potentialities inherent to their ability and environment and manifested in what they come to know. Page 153. So he further builds his ethnographic material along with three interrelated parts, such as social organizations, corpus, and medium. In the first chapter, he talks about the dynamic of practice of learning and environmental factors that shape the way how people come to know what they know. In the second chapter, he closely examines the social organizations by giving examples of ethnicity, social structure, environment, how through doing social organization is learned. So in the chapter three, he examines the corpus of knowledge in terms of history, professional, and religious frames. In chapter four, he closely looks at the medium of knowledge through the prism of oral, textual, and practice, and focuses on the importance of ritual here as the fundamental way of knowing. So in the final section, in the final chapter, he applies all this interrelated parts on the understanding everyday life in Kyrgyzstan, in Central Asia, in relation to practicing Islam. The knowledge of being Muslim and practicing Islamic rituals are based on the knowledge acquired from community, family, and the state, and how they are practicing are based what they have learned from the environment. So in other words, they all contribute to the creativity navigating their social lives. So this theoretical framework, as he argues, helps better understand how people make sense of their lives, define themselves in a meaningful ways. So in this way, practicing Islam in everyday life cannot be completely separate from the environment. So all of my comments arise from this perspective. One point that is worth highlighting is the first, you focus on mostly on different regional understanding of Islam based on what southerners claim to be better Muslims versus northerners less good Muslims. Despite all these differences, they all find legitimate claims to be Muslims. And you give us to better understand why this is so, and through the prism of anthropology of knowledge, I found this work quite convincing. But while this is anthropology of knowledge is quite new to me, and I was thinking maybe I would have explained what you have described maybe by in terms of culture, by linking identity with ethnicity and environment, and I would have analyzed in a different way. But since you are using this anthropology of knowledge, it was quite interesting to know this field and this theoretical framework. And I was struck the way how you beautifully engage with this theory, with your interesting stories. So this book is not accessible to a broad, is not only accessible to a broad student audience interested in Central Asia, but also to those who have little knowledge of Central Asia. Another thing, I know after publishing my book, the language, I started to look at the book's language, how it was written, what kind of language they used. And in my case, while writing my book on kinship, I really struggled to make understandable kinship system of Kyrgyz to broader audience, because I learned a lot of this kinship terminology and translated into understandable ways was quite challenging. But your book was quite successful in making sure that not only experts on Central Asia can understand, but also those who are not familiar with the region. So I really liked what you have written. Thank you.
Should I go?
Okay.
I like it. I don't mind. All right. Yeah, I think I will just tie in with David's book. But I have to organize my points in a way that I will always speak about the three books in relation to each other. I try to achieve that. And I think there would have been so many connecting points, and I chose three. So one thing is a performance and storytelling. Then I will try to talk a little bit about globalization and global connections and these kind of points in the three different books. And then the notion of difference and how this is sort of worked through in the three different monographs. So let's talk about first performance and storytelling. And let's start with David's book, because you just talked about it, and I think you really greatly introduced sort of the framework by Bart. And I think David's book deals with performance, including storytelling, quite a lot in this regard, and makes it a really central point of the argument, because if we look at on the one hand, the social organization of knowledge, and then the transmission of knowledge, right, and the corpus of knowledge in the medium of knowledge that sort of is tied to the transmission of knowledge, storytelling is really at the very heart of the matter, and I think that becomes really very clear in the book. And all these three parts together, and I quote, they kind of hold sway over action, as David called this, and are therefore constitutive for Islam in Kyrgyzstan. Then, with regard to Julie's book on gender politics in contemporary Afghanistan, she really observes what she calls a carnival of war. Right, it's a humanitarian theater that has emerged in the wake of military intervention. And sort of coming from a Bakhtinian take, she sees this carnivalesque moment in time sort of tied to new moral imaginations that are born out of these violent encounters. And performance is central because it becomes central to understanding the, as she calls it, the masked games that are going on there, which uncover, which cover longer histories of justice. Then finally, if we look at Magnus's book, storytelling is fundamental from a very different perspective. It's sort of his book on the mobile lives of Afghan merchants across Central Asia, South Asia, and Europe is really methodologically tied to storytelling, because he explicitly quotes the idea that it functions as a central spine of his study, and that storytelling is a really critical and durable aspect of popular culture in Afghanistan, and it is therefore infused by moral and aesthetic significance for his informants. So we have three very different takes on performance and storytelling, but I think it provides some kind of links between these three different books. We also have different sort of conditions that these performances and storytelling are inserted into. For instance, David talks about and emphasizes the cultural context of Central Asia, which is defining for these processes. Then Magnus sees performance and storytelling as an integral feature of the lives of mobile merchants who aren't really inserted in a kind of regional context, but they live in and navigate across a vast array of places across the globe. And then finally, Julie reminds us, I think, on a much broader scale, that changing the world is not only dependent on the imagination, but also on performance and on the way we perform particular identities. And in this sense, I think all three authors are on the one hand interested in specific sites, be it territorial Afghanistan or global Afghanistan or Kyrgyzstan or Central Asia, but they also aspire towards much broader claims, and that's really interesting with regard to how we can tie Central Asian studies to other fields. And that brings me to my second point, global connections. To start with David's book again, I think his book on Islam in Kyrgyzstan is, when we look in terms of globalization, is situated on two different levels. On the one hand, he observes how transnational Islamic movements, such as the Tablighi-Jamaat or the Hizb-ut-Tahrir, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, they really changed the local religious landscape, really in discursive and physical encounters with its informants. At the same time, he also frames his approach to the anthropology of knowledge as being really situated in a global context and as being of value for a much more broader context, because if the anthropology of knowledge deals with questions of existence and meanings, meaning more generally, then there is really a global implication there. And he tackles very broad questions. To put it in his words, for example, just one of the questions, what does religion as a frame contain and how can we make sense of it? And that's really a fundamentally global question. Then finally, Julie, she navigates, I think, between a focus on the one hand on the impact of continuous transnational interventions in Afghanistan since the early 20th century, and on the other hand, the conclusions we can draw from these interventions for a critical anthropology of development, really more generally. And in this regard, she emphasizes the long history of modernizations in Afghanistan, going back to the 1920s, that, as I perceive it, as I read the book, has resulted in a sedimentation of different ideologies in which the role of the woman has remained a very persistent battlefield of identity. And in this context, she carves out that not only the so-called modernizers drew on international links, if you look at secularist authoritarianism, communist rule, but also the contemporary liberal project, it's really their opponents, if you look at the Mujahideen of the 1980s, have similarly been a product of, and I quote, complex transnational assemblages who were themselves at the crossroads of modernity, technological innovation, and global conflicts. Then finally, Magnus' work on Afghan merchants brings in a comparative perspective with other studies of diasporic communities, especially trading communities around the world. For instance, the Swahili traders, but also the Hadramis of Southeast Asia. And that's a very interesting comparative outlook, because through this engagement with different historical and anthropological bodies of literature from various sites, he tries to feed in his ethnographic data from Central Asia into very different discursive spaces that are not really tied to the region. And clearly he tries to speak to different scholars who are not concerned with Central Asia there. And in this regard, I think Magnus also argues that the activities of Afghan merchants are global in significance and scale. And he does show that they're not just shady peddlers, as they're sometimes described, but they're often influential shopkeepers, they're middlemen, and they're not vital only to Afghanistan in terms of economic impact, but also to a range of other economies, including Tajikistan. And there, I think he makes the rather novel argument that after the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the war in Tajikistan, Afghan merchant used really an interstitial space to make lives for themselves within this situation and to establish themselves as critical for the country's food security on the one hand, but also due to the country's weak manufacturing sector, they started to import goods from all around the world, from various places across Asia. So we do have sort of foci on specific places, very specific places in these studies. And we have this much broader comparative perspective and links in these three books that I think are there really implicitly or really also more explicitly. And they all, in one way or the other, tackle the fundamental questions of how their informants live with difference. And that's what I would like to talk about now as the last point. I would like to talk about how the three authors sort of try to show how their informants live with difference as in terms of everyday practice and how they try to overcome it or not. David, I think, explicitly strives to contribute to the possibility of a life across difference. He calls this a practice of understanding, which is established through a recognition of what he calls the rough ground that separates people. So there are various rough grounds that he finds salient in his book. And I think he does not really only see this recognition as an academic exercise, but also as an application of the anthropology of knowledge, which he puts forward throughout his book. One example would be the continuous transformation of ethnic identities in Central Asia, and ethnicity seems to be such a rough ground and kind of problem space which he explores in detail, and in particular by the example of conflict in southern Kyrgyzstan. Then Julie's book employs the category of the woman as an entry point to explore many different questions, as you mentioned already, state building, sovereignty, democratization in Afghanistan. And I think you really position yourself really greatly beyond existing literature on wars in Afghanistan that put tribal, ethnic, and religious identities sort of in the foreground as almost a priori categories sometimes. And I think Julie also makes clear that the identity category woman, and that's really important, is not less problematic than these aforementioned categories. And I think in her books she shows beautifully how the particular case of Afghan urban women illuminates how they have been subject to continuous reconstruction efforts and humanitarian assistance, but that there are also other women in Afghanistan that she does not research about, and I think that's really important to mention as well. One example would be the striking case of a training program on gender empowerment in Kabul, in which she shows how corporate development culture can create unbridgeable gaps between expatriate modernizers on the one hand and an Afghan on the other. Then, to conclude, because I think I'm running out of time, I will just make the last point about Magnus's book and how he deals with the notion of difference. His book is really broadly about also problematizing the category of the Afghan more generally. He sees it as a category which describes not necessarily a homogenous group of fellow nationals, but he emphasizes being Afghan as a form of self-representation, which his informants use in their everyday interactions. And sort of this notion of Afghan includes a really broad array of ethnic, linguistic, religious, and political identities, which the Afghan merchants themselves sort of play with in their everyday lives, in their interactions across difference, and they employ this as a resource in many instances. So, to quote him in this regard, he argues that being Afghan is not an identity itself, but it's, and I quote, a way of identifying a complex set of human capacities, moral, cultural, affective, and strategic, on which people draw in order to navigate the ever more complex and multiple worlds they inhabit. Then, with regard to Central Asia, I think it's interesting to note that the navigation of this diversity amongst Afghan merchants is really also closely tied to Soviet history. Yes, there are some Afghan traders that he describes who have grown up as refugees in Pakistan, but a high and significant number of merchants active in Tajikistan and other places in the post-Soviet space, they actually established their crucial connections through communist political affiliation or education in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And I think here a central argument is that Afghan merchants do not primarily interact across different with a homogenous host society in the places where they're considered diasporic, but they really do so internally amongst Afghans and vis-a-vis other diasporic communities in the places where they trade and build their lives. And I take this point to conclude my short presentation.
Well, this worked out well because his last point was difference and my first point is difference. It definitely comes in the conjunction of these ethnographies. It's something that comes across very loudly and clearly, I think. And I realized that I had absolutely no summary of what was in the books. My notes are completely conceptual, so thank God for Oksana. That's actually did the job correctly. So I'll just take off a bit conceptually on a broad frame that I think is introduced by bringing these books together, as well as what I see as the major strengths of this particular comparison. So I begin with this frame of difference and the importance of local difference and an emphasis on the phenomenology of the everyday as building toward a social history, or in other words, a title I could give would be The West, a fiction we like to tell ourselves. particularly for you. These ethnographies, I think, are particularly helpful in that practice of looking again at ourselves. And in seeing dynamics in other parts of the world in a different light and helping to challenge particular notions about the construction of so-called Western democracies, these myths we like to tell ourselves. We learn lessons from local difference in Central Asia in order to do this. Ideas like the notion that democracy exists, or that economic exchange and political will are free from corruption, or that capitalism is only entirely about profit, or that women are free. Many different sorts of myths and assumptions that bring to bear in the construction of some sort of Western identity, and that in other places there are monolithic categories like Islam or ethnic identity that are somehow fixed and enduring over time in space, or Afghan, you know, as Magnus says. And one small and humble and silly thing to point out is that there is a ton of conversation and debate and negotiation in and across Central and Inner Asia about what any and all of these categories mean. That there is no such thing as a Muslim society, and that people are fighting about what it means to be Muslim, or not fighting, but discussing and agreeing and finding understanding a difference. But it's already going on, you know. And we could apply that to any of these categories like ethnicity or nationality, your gender itself, that there's a lot of kind of difference and contention about what this means. So negotiation emerges, the way that people do that, the way that people negotiate these categories, identities, and lived realities emerges as a major theme in all of these books. And shows us that even within the same families, sometimes these categories are not the same and in flux and changing, but people still feel connected and related. So how does this happen? There is a certain urgency, I would suggest, in each of these texts. When you read them, they're books that are presented here in an academic context, but when you read, you definitely feel something from these authors like, I want you to understand this, I want you to understand this. And so my comments in a way are addressed to you in the sense of, in an ideal world, who are you writing for? In an ideal world, who needs to read this? Who do you want to read this? And this question came up a bit earlier today. And I would also ask, how do you conceive of yourself as a researcher, working across different audiences or different backgrounds for yourself? Not only who would you like to read you, but how should we, your readers, look for you in these texts? Where are you here to find? The question about authorship, I think, is really striking, actually, for the ones who are here, for David and Julie, because they're both, as we've mentioned today, trapped between what David called the policy lens and the ethnographic lens. They work and live and write in worlds that are somewhere in between. I think that there's an urgency that comes from that kind of a positionality. Who needs to understand this? How can we do a better job of getting all of this across to people who are making policy, trade, and military decisions? The big question that we don't have to answer yet. I found some concepts to be the real strengths of bringing books together, so I'm going to mention just a few themes to think with that's really stood out for me. I read from somewhere, I have a position, and so of course, you know, what would seem cool to me is what I'll tell you about. And the first is the way that the category of the foreigner emerges in each of these lived transnational contexts. So Till has mentioned the way that all of these contexts that are described are quite globalized. And it's maybe describing a local situation, but we're talking about very transnational, globalized dynamics, materials, relationships, discourses, etc. So then when you enter that kind of space, what does it mean to be foreign? And all of the books introduce this in really cool kind of ways, and you see that the category of foreigner from a local perspective, that becomes interesting. What are people seeing as different or as being from elsewhere? And that the category of foreigner itself is different in different contexts. So are we watching movies and films from India and really enjoying them and maybe thinking about Bollywood? Or are we talking about, you know, international religious discourses? Or are we talking about, you know, military imperialism? What does the foreignness kind of look like in different environments or contexts? And a related theme in this regard is to show that the local is incorporating expansive networks in an understanding of itself. Connections, worldview, all of it. I think a lot about ancestors and the ways that we could construct geography or history from the perspective of ancestors, but that's the same thing. It's reaching through time, reaching through space, and letting go of the master narrative of the state, the nation state, for example. And I see that really in the material presented in these books. So what does it mean to have a culture or international reform? When you look at local politics, you're looking at actually really complicated forms of governance that come from many different places. I think Oksana's work also shows this well. I'm not discussing it today, just saying that. Another concept that I really enjoyed and found important was the notion of the extended household. The notion of the extended household in Central and Inner Asia as a way of organizing economic rationale, social relationships, and that a household, it's quite striking in the case of Magnus's work that a household can stretch over many different countries over generations. But there's some pull and there's some logic there about how a family needs to interact. In particular, Magnus emphasizes the relationship between fathers and sons, but there are all kinds of relationships going on there. And Oksana is quite right to ask, what would all of this look like from the perspective of women who organize those households and who control a lot of those dynamics about how we maintain a notion of the household over generations. So not every household can function in an ideal kind of multi-generational, neo-global, whatever that is, way, but people are still trying across national borders and different kinds of marriages and migration routes and all of these things. People are still having this notion in their minds. And to emphasize again the role of women not only in the household, but then working and out there in public spaces, participating in politics and working in the bazaar and having spiritual outlooks that they're conveying beyond stereotypes of like the perfect kelin or like a prostitute. There's like a wide variety of things that women can help us to understand. So Julie makes the important point that nobody can actually agree on what constitutes socially the good woman or the ideal woman. It's a space of contention. And when you have those kinds of dynamics, they can result in violence, but they can also become highly strategic for the people who inhabit those spaces of ambivalence. And one of the strengths of her work is to show that even under extreme constraint, a situation of extreme constraint, people can still be creative and present and publicly present in a variety of ways by exploiting precisely the ambivalence that's created by these massive globalized external dynamics. And I think that that's very analogous to what David is showing in his study of Islam, where he says nobody can actually agree on exactly what is Islam. It also creates a space of ambivalence, which becomes a space of potential, a potential for understanding, for dialogue, for conflict, for neighbors fighting, for neighbors agreeing. All of these things can happen in those spaces of ambivalence. And so ultimately, what I take away from reading these three ethnographies together is to highlight the possibility of negotiated identity, not just as a cool thing to think about, and yes, it's local, and yes, we negotiate everything, and yes, it's complicated, but as a strategic space, actually, for action and for life and for being happy and for living well, to deal with violence, to cope with migration, for a lot of different things. Magnus refers to this idea of everyday diplomacy, like what you have to do every day in the everyday dynamics of life, depending on who you're interacting with, the context you find yourselves with, who you are and who you become, and what that story looks like. So to bring it around really quickly to a final point, the identities and categories that we see in Central Asia very clearly in these texts are not monolithic, but highly negotiated, even under the most difficult of circumstances. And I think that in asking us to look at spaces of negotiation as spaces for strategic action, these texts are also definitely making us look again at the idea of ourselves and the construction of the West and the narratives that we're telling. We're all creating knowledge. We happen to be in creating the West, creating knowledge together and what this looks like. And so maybe I could ask the question again, like, what is our investment in categories like, for example, the foreigner? Who's foreign? Where is foreign? And in our own environment, across our own paths, you know, there are Afghan traders apparently everywhere, right? So, like, where are they here? And not just out there somewhere, but to find those spaces of connection and to live and write with those more.